Hello and welcome to History for Weirdos.
We're your hosts, Andrew
and Stephanie.
And each week, we're going to take you on a journey into the strange, obscure, and relentlessly entertaining corners of human history.
Now listen up, friends, because it's about to get weird. Welcome back, weirdos, to our paranormal April.
What's up, weirdos? We are glad to be back.
And we're back in a very unusual position, I should say.
That's true. We are actually in bed right now together.
In a cruise, well, in the middle of the ocean, kind
of. In the middle of the ocean on a cruise ship.
Yeah. This is a very strange situation to be recording a podcast episode. If you've been listening since episode one, you'll remember we actually recorded our first episode in my parents' bedroom.
So this is not weird at all.
Not weird at all. So this is not our first bedroom episode, but it's our first one at sea.
That's true. And to make matters even worse, we were actually really on top of it beforehand. And we recorded this episode before we left.
Yeah, prior to leaving on our trip.
And then we realized after we were done recording it, it was a great episode. And then, boom, the audio that's connected, I'm not even going to explain it. It didn't record correctly at all.
So here we are.
Round two.
This is actually my second time hearing Andrew's episode. But it's your first time. And let me tell you, you're in for a weird one.
Yeah, this one's absolutely wild. It just kept on getting stranger and stranger the more I researched into it.
You had some fun researching this one, didn't you?
I did. This one was a lot of fun.
And this one was recommended by a listener?
Yes. So big special shout out to Kay, on our who was a patron.
Ooh, not just a listener, but a patron.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Kay. Thank you for your support and for this really great recommendation.
I know. I mean, it's such an amazing recommendation. I can't believe I didn't even think about it myself.
I'm really surprised you didn't think of this one on your own. This is right up your alley.
Absolutely it is. So without further ado, should I just dive right in?
Tell us the story.
Okay, so July 8th, 1947, the U.S. Army announced something that would shock the country. They had recovered a downed aircraft in the shape of a flying saucer.
Dun dun dun!
But by the very next day, the U.S. Army officially recants that story and says the crashed aircraft was actually a weather balloon. So we're all good, right? That's the end of the episode, guys. That's it.
That would be the worst episode ever.
It would.
How funny, though, to say something as bold as a flying saucer was recovered to then make a hard left and say, never mind, it's a weather balloon. Like, you can't confuse the two. A weather balloon would be very commonplace.
Absolutely. And this just, I think, starts a trend within the government of just straight up lying to its constituents. So there were also eyewitnesses to this event, right, that tell a very different story and do not agree with this assessment whatsoever. So, which basically gives birth to the entire UFO conspiracy theory industry. I mean, you have not only an official government entity confirming the existence of a flying saucer UFO, but the U.S. Army confirming its existence and then recanting the story the next day. I mean, that's a huge deal.
Yeah.
And for the next 77 years or so, the truth has eluded the public until now. Okay, but for real, guys, we're going to go into the events leading up to the event. The event itself, described by eyewitnesses, and then some of the events that immediately followed.
Yeah, I'm really excited.
So
I've never heard this before.
You've never heard it before, exactly. So before we investigate the Roswell incident, as it's now known, let's talk about the vibes of 1947, because they weren't spectacular. So the big looming shadow that the world was living in 1947 was the aftermath of World War II. This was the largest, most destructive war in human history, and was only concluded due to the proliferation and use of nuclear weapons. In fact, nuclear weapons indirectly, or directly depending on your point of view, played a part in the Roswell incident.
Mm.
But we'll get to that in a little bit. So, the war was over, but as you can imagine, research with potential military benefits was a top priority for the governments in this era.
Absolutely. Probably every major world power.
I agree with that. And of course, patriotism was probably still a near all-time high, which does play a part in the story, actually. And it's in this immediate aftermath that you have a surge of unidentified flying objects, or unidentified anomalous phenomenon, UAP, as they are officially now called.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to call them UFOs, though, because that's a term we're all familiar with, and it's the one that, honestly, I like more.
The UAP switch was recent, right?
It is. Or yeah. It was, yeah. Within the last few years. So, there's actually this theory that's floating around that once humanity developed nuclear weapons, this was actually a signal to extraterrestrial beings saying, like, hey, universe, what's up? We're here. We have a decent understanding of physics, and we can make really powerful bombs, right?
Almost like we were finally players in the game.
Exactly. Mm. And regardless if this is accurate or not, it does start to get weird in 1947. So just a couple weeks before the Roswell incident, a pilot by the name of Kenneth Arnold was flying from Chehalis, Washington to Yakima, Washington. As he was flying past Mount Rainier, he had an unusual sighting. It was a string of 9 shiny objects that were flying at approximately 1,200 miles per hour.
Oh my gosh, I can't even imagine that.
Yeah. By the way, regular commercial jets today fly around like 550 miles per hour.
Right. So this would have been insane for him, especially in his time period. Unheard
exactly. Of. And again, this is 1947, so this is not like 2024. So it's that would have been bewildering, to say the least. And it's interesting because he described the objects as flying discs. And the press kind of ran with that term, as well as the term flying saucer, which is something I'm sure we're all familiar with now.
Oh, yeah. I've been familiar with that term since childhood because it's definitely been referenced in cartoons for a long time.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure, like, I saw a Courage the Cowardly Dog episode that had, like, a flying saucer, right?
Yeah, you're right.
I don't know why I picked that cartoon out of all of them.
That's the cartoon that would definitely have a flying saucer.
100%. I love that show.
I loved it, too, but it would scare me sometimes.
It was a little scary, yeah. So, I'm sure he didn't know at the time, but Kenneth Arnold's experience was the first post-World War II sighting of a UFO and would kickstart the modern era of UFO sightings.
Okay.
But we're here for Roswell, so Kenneth can kind of get kicked to the curb, so to speak. So here's what officially happened according to the government, right? Sometime between mid-June and early July of 1947, rancher W.W. Mac Brazel found the wreckage on his sizable property in Lincoln County, New Mexico, approximately 75 miles north of Roswell.
Okay.
Brazel, after hearing about the flying disc phenomenon, thought, huh, maybe this wreck is a flying saucer, right?
Yeah.
The wreck, again, according to the government, consisted of rubber strips, tin foil, and thick paper. And this was also reported in the Roswell Daily Record as well.
Okay.
So, on July 8th, Public Information Officer Walter Haught of the 509th Bomb Group issued a press release stating that the U.S. Army had recovered a quote-unquote flying disc near Roswell. This press release maybe single-handedly starts the extraterrestrial search industry, again, for lack of a better term.
I never thought of it as an industry, but it definitely is.
It absolutely is. And the very next day, the U.S. Army, again, like I said earlier, recants what they said and instead claims that the crash was the result of a weather balloon.
Because that's not going to make people suspicious at all. Not at all. Suddenly recant what you said.
Yes. And remember that patriotism that mm-hmm. I talked about earlier? People at this time were a little bit more willing to trust their government because they hadn't had this like history of lying to the people.
An unknown history, maybe, of lying to the people.
That's true. That's a fair point.
You're right. People definitely I don't know, we can't speak as much for other countries, but in the United States, there was such a faith in the government.
Yeah, at this time especially, and now that faith is mainly gone.
Yeah, there used to be such positive regard of like, wow, they're the good guys and they've got our backs.
Right, like we used to export democracy, and now like through technology, Facebook, we export tools that actually destabilize democracies.
Ooh, hot take.
Hot take. So, the famous photo of Major Marcel kneeling with the debris, which will be posted on our Instagram, mm-hmm. is issued as evidence saying, oh yeah, see, this is the stuff from the wreckage, and you can see it's clearly a weather balloon. But that wasn't actually the case.
And I'm sure for most people at the time when they heard about it, it did assuage their doubts. They're like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Absolutely. I think for a lot of people that was the case. So basically, the government really does not officially address this incident again for about 50 years. And of course, during this time, there's everything from total acceptance, kind of like what we said, to healthy doses of skepticism, to just outright like insane conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. And we'll cover those in detail in just a little bit. On June 24th, 1997, the U.S. Air Force does something pretty peculiar. So just a month before the actual 50th anniversary of the event, they release a 231-page report dismissing the long-standing claims of an alien spacecraft crash in Roswell, New Mexico.
I feel like that makes you look so desperate.
It's so sus.
Yeah, like, okay, that makes things look more suspicious now. Why are you fighting so hard to convince us that it wasn't a UFO?
And it just makes me think, okay, no, it's there's definitely something there.
Because if it truly was nothing, it would, even if people were spreading conspiracy theories, as long as they weren't a threat, I feel like the government would just ignore it. Like, oh, well, that's so silly. How crazy. And just move on. They have other things to do.
Right. Like, I feel like this is an example of the Barbara Streisand effect. You know? And for those who you don't know, I'm just going to keep this really quick. Barbara Streisand, like, I think there was a picture of her house, like, in a magazine back, like, 20 years ago or something. And she wanted that picture taken down. But then a lot of people got wind of it. And so then they just kept on
taking
pictures of her house. And then like more magazines printed more pictures of her house. So unintentionally made it worse. And it, as if instead if she just left it alone, then it just would have gone away.
It would have blown over, but she drew more attention to the situation.
Exactly.
That's exactly what the government did here in 97. You're right.
I think so. And interestingly, earlier in like 1994, the government said that, you know, this whole weather balloon thing, it's actually completely bogus. We lied.
Oh my God.
And then they described it in more detail in a few years later in 97. So in this report, they claim that, yes, we did lie in 1947 about the weather balloon to cover up what was then a top secret initiative called Project Mogul. Project Mogul was basically a 650-foot string that was attached to a high-altitude balloon carrying microphones and other sorts of recording equipment. And basically, the whole idea behind this was to float up really high up in the air and spy on the Soviets to see if they had nuclear weapons or not.
I'm sorry. That sounds like someone's idea of like a sixth grade science project.
I know.
Let's get a really, really long string and tie a bunch of recording equipment to it. See what it picks up.
Pretty much.
I believe that that's something they would have tried. It just sounds silly, I guess, to our modern high-tech ears.
No, and Project Mogul was real. Like, they did do that. Like, that was real. I mean, whether this was Project Mogul or not, you know, I'll leave that up to you guys. But, yes, spoiler alert, too, the Soviets would detonate their first nuke 2 years later in 1949. So the report also detailed that the Pentagon did not recover extraterrestrials, nor did they participate in any further cover-ups. You know, just the one that they admitted to, but right. No further cover-ups.
Right. I believe them.
Yeah, right. They literally titled this too, like, Case Closed, Roswell.
That's so cute of them. Case definitely not closed.
Definitely not. Because, of course, the government couldn't possibly be hiding anything further, right? Right? Totally unlike them.
Yeah.
Totally unlike them. So we've gone over the official narrative, right? This is what the government says happened. But as you can probably surmise from my tone, there's a lot more to the story, and you'd be correct. So let's talk about the specific army unit that was attached to the Roswell Army Field, the 509th Airborne. Just a side note, the U.S. Air Force at this point is a part of the U.S. Army and actually split off as its own department just a few months after the Roswell incident.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I think that's actually just a coincidence, but it's an interesting coincidence.
Yeah, they're one branch at this point.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, kind of like how the Space Force was part of the Air Force, or is part of the Air Force. I don't know.
I think it's still a part of the Air Force, yeah.
Yeah.
As it grows, it'll probably become its own branch.
I think so, yes. So, the big elephant in the room, why is the 509th so important, you might ask? Well, they're infamous for one thing, and one thing only, really. Mm-hmm. They carried out the nuclear attacks against Japan by dropping the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Wow.
And
that's dark.
Yeah, I know. Side note slash random historical fact, the U.S. spent more money on developing the Enola Gay, which is the plane that dropped the nuclear bombs, than they did on the actual bombs themselves.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That
sounds right.
I'm sure it would take a lot of planning, but that is a very governmenty way of doing things.
Yes. I mean, they did, like, this plane was very special, but I just find that, like, kind of weird and kind of hilarious. So, not only did they drop the atomic bombs, but in 1947, they were the only nuclear strike force in the entire world.
Wow.
Right? So not just in the U.S. armed forces, but in all the armed forces on Earth.
A very specialized elite team.
Yes. It's a small, exclusive group of people that could develop a nuclear strike, and no one else can.
Okay.
So it's kind of weird that they are the ones that are tasked with collecting the evidence of the weather balloon, quote-unquote, to begin with, right?
Right.
I mean, even if it's true that they were recovering the downed Project Mogul device, it still doesn't make a ton of sense. I mean, why would the nuclear team be sent out to do a simple recovery job? It's plausible that they needed, you know, the recovery team needed to have high clearance, and it just happened to be that they're the only people that have high enough clearance to do this type of job, right, in this area. But I mean, that's kind of a stretch, honestly.
It still seems like you would send someone else, like, just to pick up the essentially trash of your project that went south.
Exactly.
Not the people that can have a nuclear, that can conduct a nuclear strike.
Right, exactly. Especially during this time, like, you know, the beginning of the Cold War. I'm sure
tensions are high.
Yeah, I'm sure Truman wanted them on alert at all times.
Very, very odd.
Yes, exactly. So, and we have to also keep in mind, again, that this is at the very least an interesting coincidence. So, and especially like that it happened so close to the 509th Airborne.
Mm-hmm.
And again, especially when you consider that eyewitness testimony paints a very different picture than what the Army has come out with. So let's go back to that rancher I mentioned, that W.W. Mac Brazel.
Mm-hmm.
He described the metal that was in the crash as, quote unquote, out of this world. Something that he had never seen before and was completely alien to him. No pun intended.
Very appropriate terms here.
Right. So this was interesting because the way that both he and Jesse Marcel both claimed basically the same thing about the metal at the crash site. And that is that the metal was incredibly lightweight, like a sheet of paper light.
Mm-hmm.
And even stranger, this metal is virtually indestructible, and you could kind of fold it in your hand. Mm-hmm. So it would bend, but then when you released it, it would just pop right back into place.
Wow.
So kind of imagine, like, if you take tin foil and you can crunch it up really easily, mm-hmm. but then imagine if it would just spring right back when you let go of it.
Yeah, that's really wild.
Yes.
But also you can't just rip it apart like tin foil.
Exactly.
Hmm.
Yeah, like they tried blow torches, they used hammers, and it wouldn't break or bend. Again, this is all according to their testimony.
This is something, I mean, we are far in the future to the Roswell incident. This is something that nothing like this exists today.
Yeah, nothing that I know of is like this. So it gets even stranger. In 1978, Jesse Marcel, in an interview with a ufologist, which again, I didn't even know that was a real thing up until I was researching this episode, but he said that the material found at the crash site was extraterrestrial.
Hmm. Well, I guess a ufologist would say that, though.
Right?
Yeah.
He also mentioned that an I-beam found at the crash site had a very strange kind of writing on it. Nothing that he had ever seen before. He kind of described it sort of like hieroglyphs.
Okay. And what's an I-beam?
An I-beam, that's a great question. So all it is just a steel beam that when you look at it head on, kind of looks like a capital I.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. That makes sense.
Hence I-beam.
I thought it was like a beam into your eye.
No, nothing like that. So it might be tempting to say that he's a crackpot or he wants attention, but people who served with him in the military never described him as such. In fact, he was known as more of like a no-nonsense kind of guy. So in a word, you have a rancher and a U.S. Army officer who have essentially no connection outside of this event, but they're both saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that they found this bendable metal that was impossibly light and indestructible. Or I guess nearly indestructible, right?
Right, because it did fall out of the sky.
Exactly, and there were pieces of it and everything. Here's the thing, they're not the only ones.
There are more folks.
Yes. In fact, up until now, I've been describing a crash site. Mm-hmm. But there were actually two crash sites around Roswell that happened either on the same day or within like a day or two, possibly a few days of each other.
That's really interesting.
Yes.
It's also interesting that we don't know exactly when.
No, yeah.
Each one happened.
Yes, I know. It's very strange. So the second crash site was about 40 miles away from Brazel's ranch. So fairly close in the grand scheme of things, mm-hmm. right? And here's the thing with this site. It was a firefighting crew that was the first on scene as they had gotten a 911 call regarding a crashed aircraft. So this firefighter team gets to the site preparing themselves for what would be a large brush fire, mm-hmm. as that's pretty typical in these scenarios. But that's not the case. There isn't any fire. In fact, one of the firefighters, a guy by the name of Dan Dwyer, saw something that would change his life forever.
Mm.
He described seeing a disc-shaped craft that had partially been destroyed but was mostly intact. It was comprised of a metal that utterly bewildered him. It was super lightweight, and it could bend very easily in your hand but would spring back to normal once you let go, almost instantaneously. Does that sound familiar?
The exact same thing as the other two men.
Exactly. And here's the much bigger thing. There were three, according to him, beings outside of the aircraft. Two of them were clearly dead, but one was still alive.
Oh my gosh, what an eerie scene.
Yes, he described their faces as like akin to what's called like Jerusalem crickets, or in Spanish, they're known as El Niño de la Tierra, or like children of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And they had grayish skin and their stature was small. Dwyer said that they were like the size of like a small 10-year-old child.
Hmm.
And the craziest thing was that the alive being was clearly mourning. And Dwyer could sense a deep sadness coming from him.
Oh my gosh, how strange to, first of all, pull up to what you think is like, oh, an airplane or something crashed. We have to handle a fire. There's no fire. There's this crazy metal that you can't explain. Beings you have never seen before. And then you're feeling the emotions of another being.
I know.
Like that he could feel the despair.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so wild.
I know. So almost as soon as they were on the scene, though, a bunch of military vehicles pull up and order the firefighters to not only get the hell out of there, but to keep quiet about what they have seen. This was not before Dan Dwyer, though, was able to pick up a piece of that strange metal and pocket it.
You go, Dandwyer.
Yeah, this is important. So, one of the army men that was on the scene was Sergeant Melvin Brown, who was tasked with helping clean up the site. And he had gotten there a little bit later, and so there was already a tarp on scene that he was told not to look under, like, under any circumstances.
Okay, so he's gonna look.
Yeah, and of course, curiosity got the better of him, and he peeked. And he claimed that he saw two alien bodies, consistent with Dwyer's own words.
With the firefighter that probably left before this guy even got there.
Exactly.
So it's not like he said, hey, this is what I saw. That's crazy.
So now let's get back to Dwyer, because his story isn't done. So he gets back to either the fire station or his family home. It's not clear. But he shows his family, including his daughter Frankie, the medal, and he tells them basically, guess what, guys? Aliens? Yep, they're real.
Imagine your dad coming home and telling you this story.
I'd be like, Dad, come on, man. Like, get off the crack pipe, you know? Like, let's, what are you doing?
But as a kid, too, you must be like, oh, this is true, and everyone's going to know now.
Right.
Right? Because, like, everyone's going to believe my dad.
Yeah, and it's not the case.
Mm.
So, and it gets kind of stranger, because either that day or later that day or the very next day, Frankie is at home with her, with both her mother and her younger sister when the doorbell rings. Two military police enter her home and they sit at the kitchen table, and he asks Frankie, you know, what she saw, right? So one military policeman is with her, mm-hmm. her mother in the kitchen, and one is in the backyard with the younger daughter, which I feel is like kind of weird.
Yeah, that's weird.
That's really weird.
But again, they trust authority.
Exactly. So one of the military policemen asks Frankie what she saw. She describes in detail what she saw about the medal.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy just straight up tells her, no, you didn't. And Frankie was brought up to never lie. So she corrects the military policeman and says, yes, I did. Like, this is what happened.
Like, my dad came home and he showed us this medal and it did this.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Says the whole thing. And then he's like, nope, that's not true. So she is really confused.
Mm-hmm.
And not only this, the guy, he pulls out like a billy club and starts tapping his hand like rhythmically in a very like threatening way, right? To get her to like listen to him. And he basically tells her and her mother that if they wanted to, they could make them disappear.
This is like the freaking mob.
Yes. Like, this is the military police threatening a little child.
And her mom.
And her mom. Like,
because the little girl wants to tell the truth.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And remember the other daughter?
Yeah.
Yeah. So she's in the backyard, right, playing. And later on, decades later, she corroborates the story, right? Because Frankie comes out and says, hey, this is what happened.
Oh.
The little sister 100% corroborates. It says, yep, two military policemen, they came to our home. And, like, I was in the backyard for an hour. And while, you know, my mom and my sister were in the kitchen.
Talking to the other guy.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, you have the U.S. military threatening to kill a little girl over the events that transpired near Roswell.
Mm.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Very interesting. So the eyewitness testimony is really compelling stuff here, but we still don't have any physical evidence about anything, right? Because Dwyer was forced to give up that piece of metal.
Right, of course he was. I assumed he was like at work or something, and they probably sent military police to him.
Exactly. He was definitely visited. I don't think he ever mentioned it to Frankie, because I know Frankie said that she and her mom never talked about it again.
Oh my God.
Until the day she died.
Her mom must have been so scared.
I think so. And Dan never mentioned it again either.
Yeah, they're all terrified.
Exactly. So, in the years since, there have been many hoaxes that claimed to have evidence, right? But they've all fallen short under scrutiny. I'm not going to mention any of them except for one because it's actually kind of funny. And these are the so-called Roswell slides. But basically in 2012, so we're going
a lot further. Oh, big time jump, yeah.
Yeah. There were these projector slides that were found in a house near Roswell that contained really interesting photos. I mean, some of them were legitimate, right? Like, they were close-up pictures of President Eisenhower.
Oh, wow.
So intuitively, you can kind of, like, surmise that whomever these slides belonged to was well-connected within the government.
Right.
So a few of these slides, so you kind of look at these, and then, towards the end, there was a few slides that looked like an alien body. And people lost it, right? We have definitive proof of aliens. Again, except it was a hoax. It wasn't real. The picture of the quote-unquote alien was actually from a museum and was a mummified person, I believe, from like centuries prior.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
But I could see how it could look alien.
Exactly.
Mummification does make you shrink. And
I mean, I did see the slide and it does look alien.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's grainy too.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was a person. I mean, this is just one example, but there have been countless others. So when we examine all of this evidence that has come out of Roswell, what does it all mean to the people who want just the truth, right?
Yeah.
Not trying to prove one thing or another. We just want the truth.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much information that is either not being shared with the public, or there's just plenty of disinformation coming from either the government or like well-meaning ufologists.
But the disinformation makes you seem crazy if you believe in any of it, really.
Exactly.
Every time a hoax is proven to be a hoax, it discredits it.
100%. And, you know, not to mention that this event is pretty much what begins our modern interest into UFOs that persists even to this day. Right, this is like the starting event. Even though it wasn't the first one, it is the one that's all in our collective psyche.
Yes, I definitely didn't know what really happened, to be honest, at Roswell, but I knew Roswell equals aliens.
Exactly. So with all the people that were eyewitnesses coming out and talking about what they've heard, you know, at least makes you question, scrutinize everything that we've been told. So the question remains, were there aliens at Roswell? Was that indeed an alien spacecraft that crashed? Guys, I unfortunately do not have the answer to that. But when looking at everything that I've researched, something is almost certain in my eyes. The government is hiding something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what that something is, you know, I don't know. That's the billion-dollar question.
Yeah. Weirdos, what do you think?
Yes, weirdos, let us know in the comments, either if you're listening on Spotify, or if you're not, you can post a comment on our Instagram of this episode, because I really want to know, what do you think? Aliens or nah?
Yeah, or do you have other theories?
Yes, I like your theory about time travel, actually.
Yes, I've shared with Andrew before a lot of the incidences that we think or attribute often to being aliens or UFOs. I've wondered out loud with Andrew, is it possible that these are time travelers, that these are humans far, far, far in the future that have just come back to observe us or learn or something? So kind of like aliens, but future aliens.
Right. Or, you know, what would be interesting, kind of like how if ghosts are like facsimiles of people in the past, mm-hmm. what if like these are like kind of facsimiles of like being like us in the future?
Right. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. I really think that could be possible, because we say this all the time, kind of jokingly, but it's true. If time travel will ever be possible, that means it's already possible.
Yes.
So time kind of collapses on top of each other, right?
Oh,
very, very interesting.
It's so interesting. It boggles my mind. It really does.
It hurts my brain if I think about it too hard.
Definitely. But weirdos, let us know what you think. Genuinely curious.
This was such a weird episode.
It's so weird.
This is perfect for History for Weirdos.
I know. And especially Paranormal April. I was, you know, Kay, again, thank you so much, because this was a great idea. Like, this was like quintessential, I think, History for Weirdos and then Paranormal April. Boom.
Yes, I agree.
Roswell.
And I know you had fun. You got to watch like documentaries and stuff on this.
I watched like a few documentaries on this, and my sources also on this are like the Smithsonian, the History Channel, the Air Force itself.
Oh my God.
Washington Post, NPR, the FBI, the Travel Channel, The Guardian, and of course Wikipedia.
What a variety of sources you have.
There was just so much information. I actually excluded like some of it just because it didn't really fit well with the story, but there was so much information that I had to just piece together from all of these different places, especially the documentaries as well.
I feel like you did a really good job of making this like it wasn't linear because you did jump around in time necessary for the story, but like it made sense. It flowed well. Whereas I could see how easily this story would snowball out of control and you can't tell what's what.
Yeah, it almost did.
Yeah. No, I loved this. Thank you so much for teaching me twice now about Roswell.
Yeah, number two. I think I did a better job this time around.
There you go. You got to practice.
But guys, I think you would have appreciated that the first time I told this, I was really caffeinated. So I was talking a mile a minute.
Dare I say a little over-caffeinated?
I was over-caffeinated.
Although we have heard from the weirdos that they do like when we drink a lot of coffee before.
Yeah. You guys like it when we're like caffeinated or I'm kind of drunk, you know?
Or our ADHD is just spiraling.
Exactly. Well, to be fair, I wasn't drunk. It was like I had like a couple or a few beers during St. Patrick's. But
oh, that's right. Yes. So a little buzzed.
It was just a little buzzed, yeah. But yeah.
Well, weirdos, we have a little teaser for you for the next episode. It's actually going to take a little sidestep from Paranormal April, but we are going to have a very special History for Weirdos episode for 420. So yes. If you listen all the way through, you don't skip the end of the episode, you know here first. We're going to have a special 420 episode that you are not going to want to miss.
Exactly. And it's actually dropping early.
Ooh. Yes. See the reward you get for listening all the way through to the podcast?
Yeah.
Now you know.
It's going to be a first. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Thank you again, babe, for sharing the Roswell story. And weirdos, as always, thank you for listening. If you haven't done so already, you know the drill. Rate, review, subscribe, or share your favorite History for Weirdos episode with a friend. That really helps the podcast grow.
Yes, absolutely. Until next time, weirdos.
Until next time.
Adios.
Is it still going?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
It looks like it stopped. That's still going? Okay.